Hello and welcome to the University of California Press podcast. My name is Chris Gondek, and today I'll be speaking with Dale Maharaj, the author, with Michael S. Williamson as the photographer of Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. Dale Maharaj is associate professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. He's published 7 books, including And Their Children After Them, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and Journey to Nowhere, The Saga of the New Underclass. Michael S. Williamson is a photographer at The Washington Post who has collaborated with Maharaj on many of his books. One note about this show, I caught up with Dale while he was in transit, and he recorded his end of the conversation on a portable voice recorder. This explains the light background noise you'll hear during his responses. Dale Maharaj, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the University of California Press podcast.
Great to be here.
Now, you and Michael Williamson have been following the story at the center of Someplace Like America for almost 30 years. How would you describe the story?
Actually, a little over 30 years. The time is passing by. It began in 1980 when I met with Michael Williamson. We started covering the down and out. It wasn't an economic story at that time, but it quickly became that in the early 1980s with the recession. But it was not a recession. What really was happening was it was a fundamental change in America. They were blowing up the steel mills. They were just laying people off. So America went from an economy that relied on manufacturing jobs, Walmart was almost non-existent in those days, to now 1.4 million people working at Walmart and this incredible drop in manufacturing jobs. So basically what we started reporting on back then, we continued covering it for the last 30 years, and that's what we bring home in Someplace Like America.
Oh, was there a particular point when you went from a particular story of individuals to realizing there was a much larger narrative there?
Absolutely. We were riding the freight trains in California with the new homeless. These are mostly men who had lost their jobs back east, and they lost their car, and then they ended up on the trains. It's a long process. It didn't happen overnight. And we realized, like the grapes of wrath, we have to go back to where they came from. You know, Steinbeck had to show Dust Bowl, Oklahoma, in order for us to understand the Jodes in California. We realized in 82 we had to go back to the Rust Belt, the Rust Bowl, as we called it in our first book, and show why people were leaving and then hit the road with them and head west.
Now, this book is really kind of both yours and Michael Williamson's experiences over this 30-year period, looking back at the initial work you did in the 80s and then really taking it on up to today. But as I read this and I read the people and the places you go, if there's one place in America that seems to be a symbol for what you've written about, it would be Youngstown, Ohio. When did you first arrive in Youngstown?
We landed there in March of 1983. The previous year, they had blown up the Ohio Works, U.S. Steel's Ohio Works. There were 50,000 jobs lost in the Mahoning Valley, which is around Youngstown. It was described as a necropolis in a Wall Street Journal story. And for our purposes, it was the poster child for everything that was wrong in America. It was all crystallized and distilled into Youngstown.
So, what happened in the following 30 years from that first visit?
Oh my gosh! We followed up, and many of the people we documented back then. There's a steel worker family named the Marshalls and the Platts, and we bring their story forward in Someplace Like America. So we don't just show what happened then; we show the arc of time, how people have dealt with, or in some cases not dealt with, the transformation they've gone through. It's a very human story. We put a face on the numbers.
You are a journalist, and you are also a journalism professor. You teach students. What is the reaction when they find out the things you've done for stories? For instance, you mentioned earlier that you've hopped trains, but you've also talked about in the book early on in the 80s that both you and Michael ended up on a work crew that there was really no guarantee you're going to get out of.
Yeah, we ended up working in a de facto slave camp in Texas. I believe in immersion journalism, and there's actually many types of immersion journalism. You can spend a lot of time with people, interviewing them over and over, or you can live and or travel with them, and that's what we prefer to do. It's a very special kind of journalism. It has a cost. You're on the boxcar freezing. You're getting the gun pulled on you, which happened to us a couple of times, or the knife, or the guy who wanted to strangle me in Denver. There's a lot of danger, but I felt it was the way to tell the story, a verite kind of way to tell the story. Go out, travel with the people, live with them, go through what they go through. And so there's a high risk to this kind of journalism because you get close. And when you get close, you can hurt personally.
You know, it seems from the book that where both of you kind of crossed the Rubicon from what we might call traditional journalism to the journalism that you see in this book is when you met the man named Sam in St. Louis.
Oh, my gosh. Sam was both our dream and our nightmare. We wanted to travel with somebody who had just lost their job, and we didn't find anybody in Youngstown to travel out with. They weren't leaving at that precise moment. The descent that a human being goes through to hit the road is torturous. It's not a planned thing. People, you know, lose their home, they lose their car, they end up on the streets. So we walked into the St. Louis Salvation Army, and there was this man walking in with an Adidas bag and a racquetball racket. We knew he didn't belong. He was 28 years old. He was fresh. He was scared. We made friends with him. Long story short, we ended up riding a freight train from St. Louis to Kansas City, where we lived in an abandoned grain elevator for 3 days. We had to plot our way to get out of the really hot railroad yard there. The railroad bull, the policeman, was arresting everybody. We beat that bull. We got into Denver, and so we showed Don traveling across America and what a guy goes through those very first days on the street.
Now, you tried to follow up with Sam, and I got the sense of the book you're not sure if you did or not.
Well, we went looking for everybody who we spent a lot of time with in the early 80s. There was a family in Texas, the Alexander family. We found them and had a wonderful reunion. Sam, we wanted to have a reunion. We had joked when we were riding the train across Kansas. At one point, we were cooking Spam on my backpacking stove, and we were singing the Monty Python Spam song. We were saying, someday we're gonna get together again, and we're going to go over the pictures, and we're going to, you know, hopefully we'll laugh about this, and it'll be something we all went through. So it was something we always wanted to do, and I went looking for Sam, but he didn't want to talk. I don't know what's going on in his life, if his life is, you know, worse, the same, or he just doesn't want to talk about those days. But we go into the quest of trying to talk to Sam, and we never got to him, sadly.
This is a first, at least for me, doing my job with the University of California Press, in that your foreword, the man who wrote the foreword, is Bruce Springsteen, whom you've met through the auspices of your work. What is it that Bruce Springsteen found so interesting about the work that you and Michael Williamson were doing?
I think, you know, it's kind of funny because Bruce has always been in my head as we've done this work. He sings about working people and their trials and tribulations. I know exactly what happened. When we first met him, he stumbled upon our book in a bookstore, our first book called Journey to Nowhere. Picked it up, bought it, put it on his shelf and forgot about it. And then in 1995, when he was writing his Ghost of Tom Joad release, he pulled it off the shelf and he was inspired to write two songs from the book, Youngstown and New Timer. So fast forward to today, we got to know Bruce pretty well over the years. I had sent him a copy of Someplace Like America, the manuscript, for him to look at because he's in it. He's a character because by writing the song Youngstown, I write about that in Someplace Like America, the whole how he came upon it. And we snuck into the abandoned steel mill where the blast furnace he sings about it to Jenny in that song. And the police were arresting everybody who they caught in there. And I said, Bruce, you know, if they catch us, they're going to arrest you, especially you. They're going to make a point. He said, let's go. So we've gone through this, you know, incredible thing together. And I wrote about it, and I wanted to make sure Bruce was cool with it. So because he had sent us the songs before the CD was released and asked us, what do you guys think? So I said, Bruce, just like you wanted to know what we thought about the songs, I want to know what you think about the book. Is this cool? And I get a call about 2 weeks later from his manager, and she said he wanted to write a foreword. So I haven't talked to him since. I haven't talked to him about Someplace Like America since, but obviously he was moved by something in it to write this foreword.
We've already alluded to the fact that you are not only a journalist, but you teach journalism. Where's American journalism been in all this? Why hasn't there been a bigger stink over what's happened?
You know, that's a great question. Why are we asking why? It's cause and effect. We have to show, I feel as journalists, show America to Americans. That's our job. I think the press, and I use that term broadly, I don't like the media, but, you know, the broadcast media, the print journalists and so forth, we were focused on money for the last, you know, few decades. The story, the business pages expanded, business magazines expanded, labor beats shrunk. We stopped caring about workers. It's like we forgot that we're almost all of us are workers, except for a very narrow slice of very wealthy people. Even as a professor, I'm a worker. I don't have that much a difference between me and the steel worker as far as I'm concerned. Oh, they work harder. They get their hands dirty and they risk their lives. But so we're all workers. We lost sight of that. And a lot of the press, members of the press, ended up, you know, believing they were wealthy too. And we tend to write about those who we like to surround ourselves with. So I'd like to see some more shoe leather journalism. I think we need to see show Americans to America. We have to understand what's going on now because we have to move forward. We can't go on the way we are. We have to realize that there's a serious problem in this country. And I raise those questions in some place like America. I raise a lot of questions, and I feel my job is not to dictate what people do, but to make them think and start asking questions. The book is not polemical, and it's people. It's an other P, not polemical, but people. And I tell their stories, and I don't know if most of the characters I wrote about are liberal or conservative or whatever. I never ask their politics. That's not my point. My point is we have to care about each other, liberal or conservative. We have to take control of our lives. We have to ask why this economy is not working for most people. And then we have to move forward, build a way to build a new America. And that's the message of Someplace Like America. How can we build a new country and move forward from here?
So let's talk about a story that's happened since this book went to press, the saga of Governor Walker of Wisconsin, the Public Employees Union. How important is this story?
It's hugely important. It's a continuation of the war on workers, demonizing workers. Now, people have to remember, those Wisconsin workers agreed to pay cuts willingly. They know the state's in trouble. This was a way to destroy the union and end collective bargaining over other issues, work conditions and so forth. This started back in 1980 with Ronald Reagan, and it actually started a little before that, but you know, Reagan really steamrolled it, and the air traffic controller strike, he busted that union. And for unions to exist in this country, it requires laws that protect the workers from retribution and punitive actions. And we've gotten away from that, and unions have been demonized. But everything that I grew up with, my father was not a union man, but he worked for a steel company that was afraid of a union coming in. So it paid really good benefits and treated my father very, very well. They wanted to stop a union vote by treating the workers well. So even if you didn't belong to a union, in the 1940s and 50s, it was unions that made the middle class in this country. It made me, made my father able to make a good living to afford to raise me in a middle class lifestyle and be able to write this book. And so unions are very important to this country. I know a lot of people don't like unions. But I would hope they would just look at what they did for us and why we have the work conditions that we have today, vacations, health benefits, and so forth, all traced to unions. And this governor in Wisconsin, by continuing his attack on unions, is trying to drive us back to the McKinley era, before unions. And it's really bad.
So finally, the next presidential election is next year in 2012. Given that in this book you write about the dearth of leadership in both America's political and business classes, do you think there's any real significance in this election for the American people?
Well, where's Franklin Roosevelt when you need him? We need another FDR, in my opinion. We need somebody who's going to think about the little man. Now, FDR wasn't a saint, and he wasn't perfect, and he made a lot of stumbles and mistakes as he worked on the New Deal. But they tried to put money in people's hands. We got Social Security out of it, the minimum wage out of the New Deal, the Works Progress Administration, which did not end the Great Depression, but it put my uncle to work. And it kept him from being, it gave him a skill in construction that he used to make a good living the rest of his life. We need that kind of leadership where we're talking about how do we help average people and not just the narrow, narrow slice of the elite, the mega, mega rich, the guy last year, Tepper, who made $4 billion on his hedge fund. He paid 15% tax, where most of us chumps, we're paying 30, 35% tax. You know, the focus has been on the Teppers of this world and not on the millions and millions of Americans who work hard, take no welfare, and struggle to survive, and their story has been ignored. I don't think we're going to get that answered in the next election. It may be a few more elections from now, unfortunately.
Dale Maharidge, the author, and with photographs by Michael S. Williamson of Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. Thanks so much for being on the University of California Press podcast today.
Great being with you.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at www.ucpress.edu, where you can also find previous episodes of this show. Don't forget, the UC Press is on Facebook, www.facebook.com/UCPress. And we're also on Twitter, where we are at UC Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the University of California Press podcast. Copyright 2011, the University of California Press. All rights reserved.